morning. You're listening to The Third Degree, to SER's Environment and Social Justice Half Hour. I'm Jess Minchell. On the show today, we look at the recent series of incidents of contaminated construction sites across the state and what that means for the right to have a safe and hazardous waste-free work environment. We'll also hear how the most recent draft of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is not best science, nor Aboriginal science. That's a little later. There's been serious concern for alarm with work safety in New South Wales, with workers in the mid-north coast and in central Sydney both exposed to hazardous materials. It emerged yesterday morning that work on the Pacific Highway upgrade was interrupted when workers unearthed materials that could be the legacy of a truck crash in 1980. The vehicle was carrying several hazardous materials, including radioactive isotopes cesium, americium, as well as the notorious pesticide DDT. Bob Higgins is from the New South Wales Road and Maritime Services. He's speaking here with Third Degree's Simon Unwin.
What's happened is a few weeks ago we were excavating a cutting and taking material out of that and putting into an embankment material. And during the excavation process, we exposed on the face of the material which is a grey-coloured clay. And when it was exposed to the surface, it got orange stains on it or streaks on it, and then there was some fumes that come from that. And what happens is a number of our workers were exposed to that, and they felt a few symptoms, nauseating, vomiting and that. And we had them checked out. They're okay now. But it did raise some issues. So we put an exclusion zone around that particular area, and we got a range of experts and agencies involved to actually take samples and test the materials to try and understand what it is. Because then once we understand what it is, we can then put our management plans in place to manage it and correct the issue.
There's been a number of news reports this morning that are suggesting that the material that was unearthed is actually radioactive material that was buried in the area after a truck crash in 1980 carrying materials from Lucas Heights to Brisbane. Do you know if that's the case?
There was a truck accident in this area around 1980, and it was carrying radioactive materials from our research, and as well as it was carrying fungicides and pesticides as well. And what we understand from that is that and the information that we've got is in terms of the radioactive materials, they were contained, their integrity was kept in place, and they were moved north away from the site and had been given an all clear at that time, right? There was some other materials that were deposited in this area. A hole was dug and the material was put in there and filled. What we're trying to understand, whether it's related to that or it's something else, and we know it's a bit premature for us to say what it is until we complete these tests.
The only information that people seem to have been able to locate this morning is a parliamentary report from 82, which sort of says that when this crash occurred, there was an Australian Atomic Energy Commission officer on holiday nearby in Port Macquarie, and came and looked at the containers and said that they were undamaged. When the workers found these materials, was it in a container at all, or was it sort of exposed?
It was during the excavation of the cutting they came across this clay, a clayey material. The question obviously is it related to one or the other? And what's important for us is not to jump to any conclusions at this stage, but to do these tests and try and understand what it is.
Of course.
Very important.
Yeah. There was obviously a series of environmental impact statements and so on done for this section of the highway upgrade. The presence of this possible contamination site was noted. Was there anything done to sort of minimise the risk and danger to workers at that stage?
Yeah, as part of, like you say, the environmental assessment, we did some investigations, got some external experts in, we did tests, we couldn't find anything at that stage, some further work was done prior to construction, found some materials, you had to go and sort of arrange for their disposal, and you know, how we've gone through a process then to identify them and manage them type exercise. So this was a little bit of an unexpected one where we've got, because as I mentioned earlier, it's in a clay itself. So we've done a lot of work in relation to the past truck incident to try and understand what's there and to manage it. What we don't know is whether or not this is related to that or something else.
Finally, can you tell us when you expect work to resume on the site?
Well, what we've got is it's just an exclusion immediately around. Work is continuing on other parts of the site. And so there's bridges to be built and so forth, and there's other earthworks to the south. We're trying to wrap it up as quickly as we can so that we can identify the material, work out our management measures to respond, and then we can get in and continue the construction in this particular area.
And that was Bob Higgins, General Manager of the Pacific Highway, speaking yesterday. Brian Parker, the New South Wales Secretary of the Construction, Forestry, Energy and Mining Union, the CFMEU, is concerned at the series of events that led to workers being exposed to hazardous materials in the first place.
Over two decades ago, we had a truck that rolled over that had contaminant waste of very toxic substances, but not only that, of radiational waste. And unfortunately, at that scene of the accident, there was a fatality, but worse to get rid of the waste. And what they actually did was to bury it beside the road. The location of that wasn't exactly detected by the old RTA, and so therefore they weren't real sure exactly where the contaminant sat. But in today's terms, if you're not real sure of that issue, what you should do is do some initial grounds testing of the areas in which you're going to work, and that would bring up the fact that you would have some contaminants there. I don't know why that was ever done, and in today's terms, it should have been done. And unfortunately, just recently, workers are working away on the upgrade of the highway there and disturbed it by a big grader grading up the ground. And obviously, there's been exposure, and at least five workers on the site have been exposed. Five of them have gone off to hospital. They've been hospitalised. There possibly could have been further exposure that we're very concerned about. But that resulted in vomiting and nausea and so forth. That's still undergoing testing in regards to that.
Are you able to tell us any more about their current state of health?
Unfortunately, we haven't been given an update, and not at this stage, but we intend on being able to give you a further update probably in the next 24 to 48 hours. But I can't give you an update about exactly the state of their health at this point in time. But what's very concerning to us is about the exposure levels, not only to the workers that worked on this particular site, but also the community up in that area. I mean, obviously, that we're talking about something that's extremely serious. This is contaminated waste, that substances that have been banned out of the country for at least two decades in some cases, and that's what we're extremely concerned about. And we can't understand the lack of by the principal contractors here and the RMS in terms of the way that they've conducted themselves in the exposure of these workers and possibly the public as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem from the environmental impact statement that RMS, or, you know, at that time the RTA, put together, that they've sort of noted that there was a possible contamination site, but weren't sure of its exact location, and now as a result of that, you know, workers have sort of stumbled across it in the course of their duties. I mean, what should have happened here?
Well, the procedural processes should have been that occupational hygienist should have been brought in. There should have been a significant amount of testing that should have taken place. They could have gone off to laboratories and tested, and that would have detected whether there is contaminated waste in what specific areas, and then it could have been used in an exclusion zone. The RMS could have made a way for making a diversion around that area and took the highway on its way in another direction, or even if they had to disturb it. I mean, it would be conducted in a bigger exclusion zone, and we would have people in there with protective clothing and masks and so on, and obviously making sure that we keep the contaminants down, and I think taken away from there and taken off in a safe manner with all the procedural processes that need to be done in line of that, and dumped somewhere else that where it couldn't be disturbed. But unfortunately, it didn't take place, and we're majorly concerned about the health and hygiene and certainly concerned about the future for the workers and the community in the local area. And we're certainly very majorly concerned about the fact that the way the process has been done. Now, we're obviously calling upon that this doesn't need to be rushed at either. at this point in time that the exclusion zone should be a lot bigger than I think the 50 metres that they've got at this point in time. And there needs to be an occupational hygienist that's going to be appointed that's independent of that of the RMS or government to give recommendations about the safest way so there's no further exposure to the workers or the community.
Sure, sure. In terms of the future, Brian, given that the federal government currently is pursuing, you know, the construction of a radioactive waste dump in central Australia, which is, you know, a good 3,000 kilometres from Lucas Heights, I mean, are you concerned about similar incidents occurring in the future?
Well, I certainly am. I mean, I think this highlights the issue in terms of what can happen here. Maybe this might have happened a couple of decades ago, but in terms of all that, I mean, is there a safe way of transporting radiation or waste across the country? I would say to you, with the amount of activities that we have on our roads and the transport that we have at this point in time, it's probably inadequate. So the first thing would be, from my experience and what I've been told is if this waste is buried in the ground and it's not disturbed, well, therefore that's the best way rather than digging it back up and relocating it and so on. I just think it's bizarre that this couldn't have been detected and therefore there could have been a diversion around this upgrade of this highway.
That's Brian Parker, New South Wales State Secretary of the Construction, Forestry, Mining and Energy Union, the CFMEU. And earlier you heard Bob Higgins of the Roads and Maritime Services. Elsewhere, in central Sydney, construction workers at the controversial Barangaroo development were belatedly alerted to asbestos exposures on site. Primary contracting company Bovis Lend Lease, as well as archaeologists working on the site, had apparently been aware of the asbestos risk for some time. Work has ceased on the site until the risks have been properly assessed. Simon Unwin also discussed this with Brian Parker of the CFMEU.
Well, what we do know is that there was 15 test pits set up on the site. Out of the 15 test pits, it found positive to 12 of at least of either toxic substances or asbestos, and that was a concern. And the other issue is that no particular worker on site, only that of archaeologists and the management on the site, were trained in asbestos awareness. So no worker was trained in asbestos awareness, but they were put at the coal face to do this work, that constantly drilling and digging and so forth, and the moving machinery and very big, heavy machinery and equipment around the sites. And certainly they weren't trained in asbestos awareness or that of getting toxic substances either. And unfortunately, this could have went on since the work had started on that particular site for some significant amount of time. I'd say at least the last 6 months there's been fairly much activity on the job. And we're concerned about the exposure levels there. But not only that, the exposure levels, if you take it back to the long weekend and on the Monday and 2 days after that, we had some very, very high winds in Sydney. You've got a childcare centre that sits straight adjacent across the road from the building site. And then you have King Street Wharf that has a lot of activity, especially over public holidays, families out having a good time on the water, walking up and down. And, the exposure levels could have been great. And we're very much concerned about what that is that has contributed to. But may I say that at this point of time, that the work is still halted on the job until we've got the proper processes in place, and that being that they've agreed upon it, that an independent hygienist is brought in and the hygienist is giving us a report based upon it, and we're going to go through the procedural processes about the way that it's going to be removed safely and making sure that every worker on the site has had asbestos awareness as well as toxic substances awareness training on the job. And until all that's been completed, there'll be no resumption of work. So we're fully pleased with the outcome there.
Have workers been provided with medical tests and treatment after the possibility of exposure?
That was one of the other issues that we've done too. We've come to an agreed position now with Bovis Lend Lease, as the principal contractor on the job, that everybody undergoes medical tests, and those medical tests, along with lung functioning tests, also x-rays and so on, so they can be stored away and obviously accounted for in the near future if asbestos is detected by any of the workers on that particular site. So they've got some recourse. Doesn't help their health, unfortunately, but that's the best we can do at this stage. This shows you the very much dangers of a material like asbestos and what it can do to the body. And I'm aware of that because I was a personal friend of Bernie Banton. I had the misfortune, really, in real terms, to be sitting near his bedside the last few weeks of his life, and I can see what this terrible disease can do to you. And certainly I've got concerns there in relation to some of the workers for the near future as well.
Do you think there's any particular reason why Bovis Lendlease didn't alert workers earlier to the possibility of asbestos on the site?
Well, yeah, I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, it's in this day and age, it's all too much rush, and everybody tends to throw occupational health and safety out the back door, and yeah, they're looking for a way to make sure that they've got these unrealistic deadlines and processes that they want to meet the time on budget. And I think that they've made a fundamental mark-up here in terms of what they've done, and they've got a lot to answer for in terms of exposing workers like they have without giving them the formal training before they've sent them into the workplace.
That's Brian Parker from the CFMEU speaking about the asbestos found at the Barangaroo site. And those two reports are from the Third Degree's Simon Unwin. We'll head now to the Murray-Darling. The latest round of submissions for the latest draft plan for the Murray-Darling Basin has not left controversy behind. Changes to water flow need to be in keeping with best science, which many scientists, environmental groups and state governments are all contesting. There have been calls for recognition of Aboriginal sovereignty over the water, and the South Australian government won't support the plan without their proposed 71 changes. So what is the ecological debt owed to the states and communities living downstream from the states at the top of the rivers? Third Degree's Cameron Whalen spoke to Jonathan Lanouse, the Murray-Darling campaigner for Friends of the Earth. He begins by asking about the history of the changes to the river system.
The Murray-Darling Basin Plan came about through the federal kind of takeover of water management in the basin, if you like. Back in 2007, the country was gripped by extreme drought and many, many decades of taking too much water from the rivers of the basin were really coming to bear. The Coorong was in a state of imminent collapse. There were tens of thousands of red gums dying or dead. And the then Prime Minister John Howard finally decided that enough was enough. Squabbling states who'd failed to deal with the problem, who'd actually created the problem in the first place, weren't going to fix it, the takeover management of the river. So that led to the Water Act 2007, which at its core requires that a plan be produced that sets a sustainable limit on how much water we can take from the basin's rivers. Mm. And so that plan has taken quite a while to develop. It's a very complex piece of analysis and policy, but we're at the final stages now where a draft has just been put on public exhibition. Well, public exhibition has just finished, and they're now in the final stages of completing, putting together a plan which will go to Parliament later this year.
So despite consultation having just ended, a lot of the states, for example, Southern Australia, Victoria and New South Wales, have actually already rejected the plan in its current form. So how likely do you think it is going forward that we're likely to see the states cooperate at all? Is it even possible to appease them all?
It's certainly not possible for everyone to get exactly what they want, something that the Federal Water Minister, Tony Burke, has pointed out on a number of occasions. But ultimately, it is now the federal government that has authority and has the requirement under the Act to set a limit on water extraction that is sustainable and that is has been calculated using the best available science. So the states, to get the best outcome, need to cooperate, but ultimately they have to comply with what the federal government decides.
With the plan, how much flexibility is actually allowed for changing weather conditions or climate change? Because it's something that's going to be very long-term. So how will it change over time, if it does at all?
This is one of the key problems with the draft plan as it currently stands, is that, first of all, they've decided not to factor in to the limits that they're proposing the amount of water that is expected to be lost due to climate change. Now, there's obviously a lot of uncertainty about that, but there's an incredible amount of high-quality science that's been gone into trying to project where what the rivers might look like in 2030 and beyond. And the CSIRO has come up with a range of scenarios that range from a slight increase in rainfall and runoff through to the median scenario where we see 12% less water, and the extremely dry scenario where it's something like 37% less water by 2030. And the problem with the draft plan is not only did they not take that into consideration, but the draft plan actually proposes to set the limit of extraction at a fixed amount that can only then be adjusted by going back to Parliament, back through this tortuous process of public consultation, and ultimately a decision being made by politicians rather than a decision being made on objective science. So what we'd be advocating is, first of all, set the reduction at a much higher amount, return more water to the environment, so there's less risk that the environment will run dry like it did during the last drought. And secondly, incorporate some mechanisms in there to allow you to respond and make sure that you have to take into account the best available science and not leave that decision up to the politics of the day.
And so on the issue of the legality of the plan, there have actually been some allegations that the plan is in fact illegal under the Water Act. Could you explain from whence these allegations come and also how serious they might be for the government if the plan goes ahead in its current form?
Well, they're certainly very serious, but of course the whole reason this plan has been put out for public consultation is to gather additional information and see what the community feels about it, and hopefully the advice and the information that's come will be taken on board and they will make an adjustment. But look, at its core, the Water Act requires that the best available science is put to good use in calculating how much water we can take from our rivers, how much water we can take without compromising the key sites throughout the basin, the big wetlands and the ability for fish and birds to breed.
And the concern is that the best available science hasn't been used here.
Well, the best available science has been used, but it's been misinterpreted.
Ah.
And it's been interpreted that they've taken that science, they've said, well, really, on the best available science, something like 4,000 to 7,000 gigalitres of extra water is what the environment needs, but we are going to propose only returning 2,750. Now, it doesn't take a scientist to say there's a big difference there, and if your science said one thing, why are you proposing the other? And this is at the heart of the legal problem that they will face if they actually try and push ahead with their current approach. The science adds up to a very different number to what they've proposed.
That's Jonathan Lanouse from Friends of the Earth. There is also particular concern with the lack of Indigenous consultation in the report, in the planned basin plan. Fred Hooper is chairperson of the Northern Murray-Darling Basin Aboriginal Nations, and he has called for recognition of Aboriginal sovereignty, saying that the government has had no legal right to initially grant those water licences. He's worried that the federal government fails to understand the relationship that Indigenous people have with the Murray-Darling, particularly the importance of seeing environmental flows of the river as cultural flows. And he's speaking here with Third Degree's Cameron Whalen.
The environmental flow, mostly they look after the 19 iconic sites that they've identified within the environmental movement as being of importance to the environment of the Murray-Darling Basin. But that doesn't fulfil our cultural obligations in regards to water that's required for Aboriginal sites and Aboriginal values and obligations along the Murray-Darling.
And so in response to these claims, the Southern Australian government has actually said it wants at least 71 changes made to the plan before it can begin to start thinking about accepting it. How much are these 71 changes do you think will involve the consultation of Indigenous peoples, and would you be happy with it?
Well, look, I think that there needs to be a whole heap of changes to the plan, and we need to be able to, we need to be able to negotiate with Aboriginal people, in regards to the waters of the basin. And but I think that the South Australian government also hasn't ruled out the need for legal action as well. If they don't get their 70 changes, they've indicated in the past that they'd look at legal action, based on an opinion by Sir Isaac Isaacs, who was the Chief Justice of the High Court. For Aboriginal people, I think that we need to be more involved in the basin plan. We need to, certainly have a commitment from the government in terms of cultural flows that will fulfil our cultural obligations and values. And I think that the quicker they do that, the better. I think that also, you know, they need to look at really what the issue is around sovereignty. You know, and whether, you know, we're claiming that a lot of those water licences have been issued illegally because, you know, we believe that the state governments didn't have the legal right to issue them in the first place, nor break up the land for soldier settlements as well, you know. And what they've done was they broke the land up and issued land under the soldier settlement program, but Aboriginal people weren't even involved in that process. You know, we weren't allowed to put their names in the bucket to be called out for land grants. So, you know, I think that, you know, land and water come together, and certainly a lot of these water licences were issued to people who owned land. It's only recently that the changes came about where you didn't have to own land to trade water.
So on the lines of that, if you could explain, I was just reading your call for sovereignty, and I was just hoping you could explain that a bit further or elaborate on it.
Well, yeah, we believe that, we haven't ceded sovereignty, dominion or ultimate title over the lands, waters, natural resources and airspace of the Northern Murray-Darling Basin. In doing that, there was an order in council by Queen Victoria in 1875 that indicated that the Queen, at the time, her heirs and successors did not hold ultimate dominion or sovereignty over Aboriginal people, their places and their land, and that became law in this country, you know, through the colonies. It became law in New South Wales, it became law in Queensland, certainly Victoria and South Australia. And, I think that, the governments need to look at that particular act, and they need to look at that particular, those laws. But also I think that they need to, look at really dealing with Aboriginal people on a level playing field. You know, they haven't done that in the past. They just consult us, they talk to us, they talk about us. They do everything else. They listen to, Aboriginal people that say that they're the leaders of the country that haven't been put there by their Aboriginal peers and don't really fully consult with Aboriginal people in the decision-making process.
So what you're looking for is to be consulted seriously and taken as such?
Well, that's right, you know, and I think that at the end of the day, there's not been a lot of consultation with Aboriginal people. I know that the Murray-Darling Basin over the past couple of years, spoke to the Northern Basin in the lead-up to the proposed plan, and, we've engaged with the Murray-Darling Basin authorities. But I think at the broader level, you look at the Water Act. I don't think the Water Act looks after Aboriginal people. I don't think that it leaves us right out of the Water Act, and the Murray-Darling Basin plan can only be written on the Water Act. You know, that's what they're saying, and based on science, but none of the Aboriginal science has been taken into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there anything else you wanted to add on the issue at all?
I just think that, you know, it's about time that the federal and the state governments really talk to Aboriginal people about signing a treaty, you know, developing a treaty for Aboriginal people and with Aboriginal people, and not just looking at including us in their constitution. You know, I think that if they're serious about including Aboriginal people in Australia, then we need to look at a treaty that from a base of equality. I think that, you know, we're treated in this country really as third and fourth class citizens in a lot of cases, you know, and that's what we need to do. We need to do it from a base of equality.
That's Fred Hooper from the Northern Murray-Darling Basin Aboriginal Nations Group, speaking there with The Third Degree's Cameron Whalen. And that's all we have time for on The Third Degree. Stay tuned to Steph on The Daily.